war is the lowest form of communication. Blam, blam, blam.
I was considered a premature anti-fascist. That was before the army got orders to be against fascism.
It was a time when you weren't allowed to break down. You weren't allowed to get sick.
And I said, boy, we're going to get it now. Sure, here it comes.
And even if you were sick, you still showed up because literally people will die if you don't show up.
I looked up and his whole body was gone. Top of his body was gone.
I guess I learned how to survive.
Oh, I don't go insane easily. I don't panic, and I don't enthuse very much.
No, rock and roll music kept me sane here. I was there. Really, really, really.
This is War Veterans.
This is a war universe. War all the time. That is its nature. There may be other universes based on all sorts of other principles, but ours seems to be based on war and games.
War is thus divine in itself, since it is a law of the world. War is divine in the mysterious glory that surrounds it, and in the no less inexplicable attraction that draws us to it. War alone brings up to their highest tension all human energies and imposes the stamp of nobility upon the peoples who have the courage to make it.
I would say it boosted my draft, they say. So you could volunteer for the draft, unfortunately. And so I did 2 years, signed up for 2 years, and told them I wanted to be either a chaplain's assistant or a medic. And fortunately enough, they made me a medic.
No, I was I enlisted primarily because my father asked me one day when I'd been out of high school a few weeks. I wasn't really doing much but just kind of partying, and he said, well, you've got to go to school, get a job, or go in the military. So anyway, he pulled out his Airborne album and showed me his, he was in the paratroopers and in the Army 22 years, and he showed me that album and kind of lured me into that, which turned out to be kind of a mistake in a way, because if you're going to enlist in the military, you should consider that you might be able to get something out of it, possibly. And I joined up as a paratrooper, and then they put you actually into like an infantry outfit, which puts you in harm's way, you know, and that isn't really what my intention was. I just wanted to be a paratrooper, but I didn't know what that was. So, you know, my father didn't really give me a complete picture.
Well, I came from a small town in Pennsylvania, and I went back to New York City when I was 17 and went to nursing school at a place called NYU Bellevue. After my graduation, I worked in their emergency room, which is probably the biggest trauma center in the United States, and got an awful lot of experience. And when I finally, after 2 or 3 years, felt like I had conquered that, one of my crazy friends said, why don't we go to Vietnam? It'll be like Paris in the war. And it seemed like a great challenge. So off I went. And it wasn't quite like Paris.
So I got in. And a few months after I got in, they started the lottery. And I remember when the lottery numbers came out in the newspaper, and I looked up my birthday, June 24th, and I said, wow, number 358, there's no way they're going to draft me. But I was wearing a green uniform, and I was standing in the barracks as I said that, so it was a few months too late to save me from joining.
At the time, I had graduated from college, and I had a degree in English. And I graduated in Boston, and I'd moved back home to Texas because I didn't have a job, and my family was in Texas. And I was very undirected. I hadn't a clue what to do with myself. And I had gone to Catholic schools my entire education, and I was totally not interested in the military or anything to do with uniforms. But one day I was looking for work in Houston, and I ran into a guy that I knew that I had liked. And he and I went out for coffee, and he was really upset because he was engaged and he really needed the job and all this. But nobody would hire him because he was 1A and he was in the Marine Corps Reserve. And I came away from that just feeling like it was not fair. It was really not fair that because he was a guy, he had to deal with that. And because I was a girl, I didn't. And somehow, I mean, looking back, it's kind of hard to trace all that, but somehow that really affected me. Like, this isn't fair. And so the next day, I think, I actually went down and talked to the recruiter.
Well, The Germans were saying, today, Germany, heute, Deutschland, and morgen die ganze Welt, tomorrow the whole world. And they couldn't do that without a war. So the place to stop them was Spain. And if it weren't for the governments of Britain and France and the United States, we would have stopped them in Spain. I was unemployed. So I was free.
I mean, for me, it was a lark.
Well, I really went on whim. And I was looking for adventure.
No, it had to do with the war itself, really.
For me, it was like a way to get out of Baytown, Texas.
I hated New York City. Went into nursing school, and when an Army recruiter came around and asked if I wanted to join, I thought, yeah, well, why not? And I said, well, do I have to go to Vietnam? You know, the Vietnam War was happening at the time. And she said, oh, no, you don't have to go to Vietnam. Women have to volunteer.
It may have been something like waking up one morning and hearing that Pearl Harbor had been bombed. I was in high school at the time. My friends and I all got together immediately and decided what we were going to do. And we were all going to enlist in one service or another. Several of us went into the Air Force. Within a week, we'd signed up. And then it was a matter of waiting.
I was an art student living in Denver, Colorado, going to class at night, working, a grunt job to get enough money to pay rent and tuition and things like that. And a family friend said, oh, you've been struggling so hard to get through school, and then you can be an officer, and they'll cover all your education. And I was at a place where anything looked better than where I was. And I came from a family. My dad was a Marine in two wars. Not a lifetime military person, but, so I was raised with a citizenship streak. I call it that rather than patriotism, but citizenship, feeling like that everyone should do something important for our country, whether it's Peace Corps or I guess for me, it turned out to be the military.
Flying was everywhere. All my friends and I were running around the yard making flying noises with our mouths and flying little toy airplanes and crashing them and colliding them and playing war.
And I went, oh, well, this is cool. I can leave New York City. I can do something in response to John F. Kennedy's What Can You Do for Your Country? Because he was somebody that was very important to me. I was in junior high school, about 12, 13, when he was assassinated, and I was greatly affected by that.
I was flunking out of college. It took me 2.5 years to lose my student deferment and get drafted. And instead of going into the Army, I was prevailed upon by my father, who was an Air Force pilot, to enlist in the Air Force, and that's what I did. I idolized him, and I was not at all sure that he wasn't right to be supporting the war. I didn't really want to go look, but it was more interesting than what I was doing at the UCLA at the time.
And looking back, I feel like I was so naive.
We had to fight. We were part of that war. We caused it to happen because we stayed out of the League of Nations.
I was just out of high school, and I had a chance to play pro baseball. And I had a chance to play with Oakland Oaks. And Billy Martin was there, and Casey Stengel was a manager. And they saw me play here, and they asked me to come down, and they wanted to sign me. And I was already drafted, so I couldn't go. I was just on 21-day leave, and I was playing this ball game, and they saw me and they wanted to take me, and that was one of the biggest breaks I had in my life that I couldn't complete, because of the war. And during the war, my life had changed.
War is the great scavenger of thought. It is the sovereign disinfectant, and its red stream of blood cleans out the stagnant pools and clotted channels of the intellect.
When these people tell their stories, the story has a coherence, or at least there's an urge toward coherence. Even if it's a string of anecdotes, there's some kind of grasp at meaning. So listening to these stories in fragments, as we're doing, kind of betrays the stories in a way. And yet, in another sense, that's how they were lived. And if you hear the stories, you remember them in fragments. So think of this as more walking along the beach, picking up pieces of shell.
Well, it was very exciting for about the first 3 days. And then I arrived in basic training.
Well, that was funny. After spending a year being trained to be a highly trained signal technician, I dug ditches for the first month. I learned to fix trucks for about a month. And then largely after that, I drove trucks and ran a log cabin bar for the troops.
And I got out of the school. The taxpayers had just spent many thousands of dollars and 6.5 months of my time teaching me to make maps. And they sent me to Fort Riley, Kansas for my duty station, and they said, a map maker, huh? Gee, we don't need any map makers here. Would you rather be infantry, artillery, or armor? So I said to myself, infantry's right in the middle of the crapola, and armor's in the middle of it, but they've got a shell around them. But artillery's a couple miles back. So I said, I'll be artillery, thank you.
So it's that thing of, you know, getting up in the morning and putting on your web gear and getting your ammo and your hand grenades and your rifle and your make sure you got a machine gunner sitting next to you. And we had rules, and we couldn't go without a spotter plane, an O-1 bird dog. And it had to have a minimum of 3 vehicles, and you had to have a minimum of 6 guys and 2 radios and 2 machine guns and stuff like that. So I guess we were taking it seriously. So I would make that drive, and every time I drove by where they'd killed all these guys, I would, you know, wonder, was this the time that they'd get me?
Well, I guess the most dangerous situation would be just being shot at.
Well, we got shot at with artillery quite frequently. But other than that, we weren't terribly close.
Well, I have an interesting situation because I don't know if I killed anybody, but I tried. And then I saw people killed, and I did shoot at people that I could see. But it's all very crazy and insane, and it all happens very fast. And you don't really always know what happened. And so that's just something to live with. That's something that, you know, people don't believe in ghosts, but ask a veteran, a combat veteran, and they know what ghosts are. Even if they're flying at 30,000 feet, dropping bombs, they have to live with that for, you know, the rest of their life.
The biggest danger was once when a ship blew up under us. We were supposed to have 2-second delay fuses, but on this occasion, the bomb went right in the side of the ship and hit the magazine. And there was instant detonation, and we could see wreckage flying up around us. We were flying through a cloud of wreckage. I looked out my window, and I could swear to this day that I saw a startled Japanese sailor blown up out of the ship at eye level, looking at me as the plane whizzed by.
And airplanes were swooping and rising over there, and it looked so beautiful until we realized they were strafing. That was the second line. We were the third line. And then all of a sudden, a line of tanks came over the top and came down. It got about halfway down, and the hills started turning black. It was the Italian army.
And I ended up on an intensive care unit that was half burns, severe burns, and half amputations. When it was a simple amputation, it was not a problem. But if it was an amputation with belly wounds and chest wounds, we're talking complications, and that's who we ended up with in the ICU unit. And the burns were severe burns, usually phosphorus burns from phosphorus grenades, which burned all the way through the flesh. You could smell the flesh.
So that shifted to taking guys from helicopters into the ER and, you know, changing an IV, cutting their clothes off, cut the boots off, cut their clothes off to see. Tell it more experienced the nurses and doctors deal with the wounds that they have, you know, cutting bandages off them.
Anyway, we used to tease and flirt and try to keep their minds off their wounds when we were triaging and going through and starting the IVs and getting them ready for the operating room. So coming down the line, I had maybe 15 or 20 patients to assess. About a third or fourth down the line, I see this kidney's laying on his
on his stomach, and he's absolutely gorgeous. I'm talking Brad Pitt gorgeous. He has like golden eyebrows that are kind of like sun bleached, and this big shock of yellow hair, and his eyes, I'll never forget, were like bottled green, and they were so beautiful. And I just said to him, you know, you've got the most beautiful green eyes I ever saw. And he arched his neck back, and the whole rest of his face was shot away. Well, you don't forget things like that. They stay with you. They stay with you when you see green eyes. And that's the kind of thing that stays stamped on your brain. You look at that kid and you think, he's never going to laugh. He's never going to kiss. He's never going to talk or sing. And then, of course, you go into automatic mode, and you turn him over, and you get the tracheostomy set up. You call the doctors over, and you secure his airway, and you get him ready for the operating room, and off he goes, and you never see him again.
War makes rattling good history, but peace is poor reading. War is nothing but the continuation of state policy with other means. This war, like the next war, is a war to end war.
Mostly, I tried to be invisible, do my time, get out.
And we hauled these tanks up, and the tank crews, like I say, the tank crews got in the tanks and drove them off. We sat down, and we were going to have dinner. The company that we took them to, they fixed us dinner. And we were sitting there, and all of a sudden, all hell broke loose. Trucks were driving fast, going crazy all over the place. And what it was... the rumors had started that the Germans had broken through. So we started out to take off, and when we got out on the road and saw all the people screaming around, it was just unbelievable, the panic that existed. Turns out that the problem was some GI had gotten drunk and was shooting at Frenchmen, and that was a German breakthrough.
And the Spanish roads are Roman roads, straight like a ruler from town to town. So they would mount machine guns and fire down the highways at night. We were put in column of two down the ditches. And the bullets went down the road. So we were perfectly safe, but it's the sound of a spent bullet. It's as if it's just drifting along hunting.
You know, my job in England was to be the what they call the WAF squadron commander. My mandate when I first got there, the only thing the colonel told me he really cared about was I was to make sure that none of these girls got pregnant and had a baby on active duty. I have no idea how they expected me to do that. Now, girls, don't you get pregnant. Yes, ma'am, we won't. You know. Oh, God, that was a funny place. It was a funny place.
And it's got its good side. You meet guys from all over. It broadens you a bit, you know. You make some friends.
And, you know, we go to the chow hall for lunch and ask, well, can I have a leg? And the guy would give you this funny look and say, oh, it's fish. It's like, okay, just give me something. Food was not a high point.
Well, about that time, they told us to get out of there. And on the way out was when I got wounded. Felt like a sledgehammer. And it broke my leg.
And they were all getting ready to go, as I said, to Thailand, and I was the training officer, the ground training officer. So a bunch of the guys came to me one time, and they said, you know, Lieutenant, they got some really terrible snakes in the jungles over there, and we're going to have special training, snake survival training. So they were very serious. They had me all worked up about this snake survival training. And they told me about snakes like the bedwetting cobra. But, oh, my God, you poor guys. They literally had me calling around to universities to find a herpetologist who would come in and conduct snake survival school. They let that go on for about 3 days, and then they finally admitted that it was all a bunch of bull. So, man, I was mad.
And we flew a very tight formation, and that of course, masked all our guns, and an incoming fighter would meet the firepower of a couple hundred guns. Tracer bullets would converge on the plane, and it was terrifying for fighter pilots to see that, and many of them chickened out. Many of them just couldn't get themselves to fly through the cone of fire. On the other hand, once we got into it, once in a while we'd get a kamikaze trying to hit us, usually trying to hit the lead plane. And on at least one occasion, a kamikaze flew directly at me, and I had to dump the plane. I just shoved the wheel forward and got out of the way, and the plane whizzed over. Barely missed.
We didn't take care of prisoners at all for a long time. They were just put in a kind of a corral and play coup. And if they died of their wounds, they died of their wounds. And so one day, my commander comes into the Quonset hut and he said, "We've changed our policy and we're going to begin treating wounded prisoners." And I rejoiced. I thought this was absolutely wonderful. Well, he had a guy with him who brought out like a ream of paperwork and said, "What we're doing is a study on the effectiveness of our weaponry." But anyway, we took the prisoners and we did the paperwork. And pretty soon we had a Quonset hut that was absolutely full of prisoners, and it stunk in there. You know, we were raised in the 40s where the Americans were the good guys. So it gives you pause.
War can only be abolished through war. In order to get rid of the gun, it is necessary to take up the gun.
Of course, when I was in the hedgerows, at one time I was a scout. So every morning I'd leave the company or leave the squad and go out 100 yards ahead and proceed to contact the enemy. I like that, being a scout, because I make my own decisions. One time I was in scout and I was going across this field and I saw a sun glint on the barrel of a gun. So I turned around and started to run back to where I came over the hedgerow, and the machine gun started firing at me, and I could see the bullets going between my legs when I was running. And of course, that made me run all the faster. So when I got to the hedgerow, I grabbed a limb to dive over it, and he cut the limb right out of my hand. And I dove over the hedgerow, and when I sat there with my second scout that was behind me about 50 to 75 yards, I started laughing. We both were laughing that he missed us. I couldn't believe it, you know.
War ought to be the only study of a prince. He ought to consider peace only as a breathing time, which gives him leisure to contrive military plans.
And that afternoon, we ran into a German point that was pretty well grouped with a lot of soldiers, and so we went in to push at them, and they circled around the back of us, cut us off. And so the sergeant said he'd go back and get the rest of the men and bring them up to our level. And so he tried to go back, but they shot and killed him. And then the corporal, the second in command, he decided to go back and get it. So he goes back, and I didn't hear from him. So I decided to crawl across his field. And there was grass in his field. And I started to crawl across this field, and there was a man behind me. There was an elderly man with glasses. He said, I see a German. He says, "Give me your gun. My gun won't fire. My gun won't fire." He was crawling. He must have got a lot of dirt in the gun or something. He wouldn't fire. So I shoved my gun to him, you know, and I saw him when he aimed it. I looked down the barrel, and he was shooting our corporal. Our corporal was right alongside the hedgerow, and he was still alive, and he shot and killed the corporal.
My home policy, I wage war. My foreign policy, I wage war. All the time, I wage war.
So I kept praying. Then the Americans started shooting again, back and forth. And then I was finally got into a prayer where I felt, I'm kind of a religious person. I felt that he was there with me. And I could feel a pressure on my head back here that told me to stay. stay where you are. Don't go over that hedge rope. Stay where you are. So I relaxed because I thought he was there with me. And I relaxed. And then they were shooting back and forth, and it didn't bother me. It didn't bother me. And it was a weird feeling, really.
If we justify war, it is because all peoples justify the traits of which they find themselves possessed.
We were recovering a tank up on the Elbe River, and VJ Day, I had been put in a hospital. They thought I might have had appendicitis, and we were watching a movie, and in the middle of the movie, everything stopped, and the lights came on. And some guy came out and stood up in front of the audience and says, "Well, it's all over." You know, and pretty soon at the back of the audience, somebody said, "Well, let's see the movie."
The most beautiful thing I've ever seen was the love between the soldiers. They loved each other. It was beyond brotherhood. It was beyond homosexuality. Had nothing to do with sex. It was the love that they had for each other. And, you know, they would beg us not to let him die. And he's got children. He's my best friend. He saved my life, blah, blah, blah. All these wonderful things that these men had done with each other. You know, proving that brotherhood is beyond anything most people could ever understand if you've not been in a war. And it was just so profound and beautiful. One night, two soldiers got drunk and they got beat up. One guy got beat up and he came in with his friend. And he got beat up because he was calling these black soldiers every name in the book. And his friend just treated him like a wife would, you know, just calm down. Oh my God, these nurses and doctors, they're officers, you know, don't say those words, you know, just go, no, just calm down, please calm down. And he finally calmed his friend down, and we sent them off to x-ray. Now his friend was black. He was calling these guys all kinds of awful names, but his best friend, he was standing there, was black, and he just totally didn't care. It was his friend and he was gonna take care of him no matter what. It was unconditional. And that's something you don't see in real life. And that's something I wish I could see in real life. You have to be in a war zone in order to appreciate life and love that you can have with another human being that's beyond a romantic love, that's beyond a father-child love, beyond a brother love, just way beyond. And I hope they both made it through.
Returning was strange.
The war really shifted my life, you know.
It cut a big chunk out of my life. When I came back, I went into the same sort of thing I'd been doing before. I came down to join Shirley. We'd been married by then.
I didn't nurse for 9 years. I thought, well, I'll go back to Bellevue. I can handle it. And I got my old job back. And I think I lasted 3 days.
And I remember one of my last fist fights that I won, a Canadian guy that I was hitchhiking with and Morocco gave me some crap about, you know, warmonger, so I beat him up to show that this pacifist stuff wasn't going to get by me.
Back to civilian life?
No trouble at all.
Relief. I came back from Vietnam, and I was a very changed person. I was a very angry person. I'm still angry.
I immediately, the first thing I did when I got back to my parents' house in Connecticut was I told my mother I had an important chore to do, and she said, "What was that?" And I got all my olive drab stuff together and made her drive me immediately to a Goodwill box to drop off everything but my field jacket and my gloves. They were good gloves.
The stuff that was essential about me, I made sure didn't change. I was pretty successful in still being pretty much the same guy in important ways when I came out as when I went in.
I felt very much like a stranger in a strange land. The country had changed. I was away for the change. I remember I got back to Berkeley and, you know, girls weren't wearing bras and people were publicly smoking dope and all these improvements.
And when I got out of the Army, I was sad to see that there were no jobs for artillery fire direction center specialists in the local newspaper. So that didn't do much for my career.
And this woman, Linda, calls back and she said, "You're the first combat nurse I have gotten to talk to since I came back from Vietnam." And so we talked for hours and hours and hours, compared notes. And then she said, "How's your physical health? I said, well, it's funny that you ask. So I kind of gave her a list of some of the problems I had. And then she said, how are your children? And I said, well, that's really funny that you ask. So I told her, and she said, have you ever heard of Agent Orange? Well, I told Linda, yeah, I heard about Agent Orange. I said, but it's just, wasn't it just the guys that sprayed it? She said, Lily, you were drinking the water.
I turned 21, came back, had my nervous breakdown. Or my wife left me, and then I had my nervous breakdown. In 6 months, Thorazine, and good as new, shipped me out into the world. And so I had basically a lighter weight encounter with a war than so many of my friends. And I'm more damaged than many of my friends. And yet I'm so much more normal than others of my friends along the way.
I remember working at my desk one day, and an aeroplane buzzed the plant that I was working at. And I headed for under the desk.
I didn't really want to talk about the military at all. And I basically drank for like 6 months straight and didn't really know how to deal with it. I didn't really have any direction that I could go. But later on, I ran into the hippies and joined their army. And I was really grateful for their ways. So.
But living 5 years outside the country was a wonderful experience. I mean, it really opened my eyes to the idea that this country isn't all there is, and that we don't have all the answers, and that people can live quite well, you know, in other places.
You know, I saw the monks by the side of the road, and it intrigued me, their serenity and their peace and amidst all that occupation. But something touched me, and I started investigating, and I've had three or so different Tai Chi teachers, and now I am one, you know. I'm a daily practitioner, 30-plus years.
I would say that in getting to be a pilot and fly some of the world's most powerful aircraft at the age of 18 was a major empowerment. Gave me a sense of personal power that I can't imagine getting in any other way at that age. I think that has affected the rest of my life in various ways. It made me feel that I was capable of doing just about anything I set my mind to.
Yeah, it's hard to come back and realize that being on adrenaline for 18 months and being scared for 18 months warps you and makes you not a happy person. So I guess you come back, as they say, at the end of platoon, hey, man, it's all gravy after that.
So a lot of my work now is about helping veterans. I mean, I was a child when my father came back from Korea, and he came home with post-traumatic stress. They didn't know what that was then, but I knew my dad wasn't the same man that left when he came back.
And I realized every time I went out into nature, I would play this little game where I was wondering where I was going to be attacked from and figure out where I was going to go hide or how was I going to defend myself. And I did this for 15 years after I was back from Vietnam. And then finally one day I said, no, this is enough. I can enjoy myself. And, you know, it's like a beautiful Sunday morning here in Northern California. Nobody's going to attack me.
But even today, when I'm out in the woods, I'm a soldier when I'm there because I look at the landscape and I take precautions. I think to myself, well, I better go behind this tree and watch the other tree, just like I was in the service, you know. It's burned into me. I do it automatically. And I don't like it. You know, I don't like it.
Because every time there's a helicopter would fly over the house, I run outside. I'm still doing it. Depends on the helicopter. it's still inside me. And it'll never leave me. It's still inside me. I can ignore the chopper sometimes. I can hear it. But I know what direction it's coming from or going to without letting myself run outside. And other times I just have to run outside. I just got to do it. Just got to check to see if I have to go to the hospital and receive the wounded.
One of my last experiences, because as I said, I got pregnant. And when I found out I was pregnant, I called up and it's like, hi, this is Captain, you know, so-and-so, and I'm calling to get the results of my pregnancy test. So this airman on the other end comes back on and he goes, ma'am, it's positive. And I mean, he was almost whispering, like he thought it was some horrible disgrace. And I went, whoopee! I said, it's okay, Airman, I'm married. He goes, oh, ma'am, congratulations. So a couple of weeks before I got out, they had IG inspection. The team comes in all of a sudden. Well, they came in on Mother's Day. And by this time, I could barely fit in my uniform. I was only a couple of weeks before getting out. And I can remember I was so pissed. How dare they do this on Mother's Day, you know? And I had to go in with a gas mask hanging off and my PIV helmet, you know? And the officers in my unit took one look at me and they said, "You in the back office. We don't want anybody seeing you." That was my last experience in the Air Force.
Anyway, I wasn't bound and determined not to let the experience distort my view of life. And it really was a transformation, because the suffering that, you know, that war inflicts and the effect that it has on human being, you hate to see more generations come after you and have to go through it as we're viewing now.
So when I came back, I tried to play baseball again, and it wasn't there anymore. That baseball thing really bothered me right up to this day. But what really bothered me during this time in combat, I killed 3 men. I saw 2 that I killed. It's easy to say, oh, you're protecting the country in your war and stuff, but you killed a human being. And I saw the ones I killed. When I came home, I thought it was time to play catch-up. I was an old man. The war makes an old man out of a young guy. You can believe that. No matter how well you are, I was a good soldier, but it still makes an old man out of you. And I sent all my kids to school. One of them graduated from Harvard, the other one from Wisconsin with doctorate degrees. But I don't know. That war mature changed my life. I know what basic training is. It's just to condition you to be a killer, and that's what they did. And you had to be, I guess. I don't know. I don't know, you know, but I didn't like that killing. And everybody says, well, you're just protecting yourself. Yeah, that's true. That's true, but you killed somebody. And if you look at the commandments, thou shalt not kill, you wonder, what is right and what is wrong? I'm confused.
When we asked for people who had served in the military during wartime, obviously we weren't looking only for combat veterans. It was about how lives change. And so there's another kind of veteran, and we thought, well, is that quite relevant? And we decided, yes.
My husband and I met in 1965, and we got married in September of 67. And we knew at the time that he was probably going to go to Vietnam. It was a pretty strong possibility. But he wanted to get married before we went to Vietnam. So we did. We planned a wedding and we got married. And I got pregnant immediately, which was totally an accident, because I had been told by a gynecologist that I couldn't get pregnant, that I needed to have major surgery before I could get pregnant. As it turned out, I got pregnant immediately. He got drafted. And so when he got drafted, he went to see a recruiter. And the recruiter said, if you enlist for an extra year, we'll guarantee you an administrative job. He never got the administrative job. He got a little piece of paper that said, we guarantee you an administrative job. That was in his wallet that came back from Vietnam after he was killed. And he carried that little piece of paper around like it meant something. And every time he'd get orders, he'd pull out that paper and say, well, what about this guarantee that I'm going to be in administration? And they would just laugh at him. So that's how he got in the Army. Pretty much, I felt like I really couldn't do anything about it. Like it was just like this snowball that just kept getting bigger and bigger, and I couldn't really change it. You know, he was going to war, and, you know, it was inevitable, and the war was getting bigger and bigger, and I really felt powerless and helpless, like I can't affect any change. My husband, I think, when he went to Vietnam, he felt that it was his duty to fight communism. His father had been in World War II, and he was a patriot, you know. He was going to do his duty. He was going to go to war if there was a war going on. And, I mean, he didn't really want to go, but if it was his duty, he was going to go. So he went over there believing that he was fighting communism. And in one of his last letters that I got, he was beginning to find out the truth of what was really going on, and that the war was being fought for economic reasons. I can't remember the exact line, but it was kind of sickening to him. He said something about it's rather sickening to see that human lives are being used this way. And within a month, his life was used the same way. Anyway, he was only there 2 months before he was killed in action in Saigon during the Mini Tet Offensive. And by then I was 7 months pregnant. How did I get the news? Well, intuitively, I knew he had died. I got a forewarning. I was reading the paper one Sunday, and I saw an article about a battle in Vietnam, and it was way in the back pages of the St. Louis paper. I was living in Southern Illinois at the time. And the article was directly about my husband's unit. It was his company, his platoon, his battalion. All the numbers were there. And I thought, my God, this is him. And at the end of the article, it said, we were lucky. We had only 4 killed and, you know, so many wounded in action. And I knew at that moment that my husband was dead. And I just went into this episode of crying, and my mother came out and said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "He's dead, Mom." And she said, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "I just know he's dead." And then 5 days later, those 5 days I was going through hell. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. 5 days later, the Green Army sedan pulled up in front of my parents' home. And I went to the window and I told my mom, they're now coming to tell me that he's dead. And that was the case. They sat in the car for a long time. 2 men got out and straightened their uniforms, put their hat on and walked to my door. And, you know, when I opened the door and they saw my pregnant abdomen, I'm sure that must have knocked them for a loop. They wanted to know, they were looking for Pauline Query. And I said, "I'm Pauline Query. That's me." And they just were silent for a long time. And then finally they started reading this telegram that they had. They actually literally read it to me. "Your husband has been mortally wounded." And my mind just started racing around, "Mortally wounded. Does that mean dead? Does that mean alive? If he's wounded, maybe he's still alive." And I was really very shy at the time. And I just tried to figure out in my head what that meant, mortally wounded. And they came in and then they just went through everything with me. The cemetery, the body will come back, the medals. I only retained bits and pieces of that. I was in shock. And then they left. And then it was 2 weeks after that when his body came back. And when his body came back, it said non-viewable. And what that meant was that it was hermetically sealed. We could not open it. People wouldn't let me cry. They kept saying, "You have to be strong because you're pregnant. You have to eat. You have to sleep. You have to take care of yourself because you're carrying his child." So my life then became about his child. Yeah, yeah. My daughter, it was amazing. She looked like a little version of my husband. I just was shocked when I looked at her. I thought, my God, I have given birth to him. She looked exactly like him. I remember thinking, you know, I have to look at her to see what's wrong with her, because I have to look and see where she's damaged. Does she have 10 fingers? Does she have 10 toes? Is her head okay? Because I just felt that she was going to be so damaged by the trauma that I went through. Well, as it turned out, she was traumatized, but it wasn't trauma that I could see. Right now, she's 35 years old, and she's experiencing severe panic attacks and anxiety. And I'm not surprised. Our country is at war. And she told me once that every day when she wakes up, the first thing that enters her mind is, "Who's going to die today? Who do I love is going to die today?" I was living with my parents at the time in a very small town in Southern Illinois. I remember looking back that I was kind of numb, and I look at pictures of myself and I just see a dead woman walking around with a baby in her arms. I could never hold a job. I could never have a healthy relationship with a man because I had all this turmoil inside of me. And in 1990, when I lost a job and ended a relationship, both of which were very significant, I fell into a deep depression and I was suicidal. And when the pain gets that deep, you either kill yourself or you heal. And I probably would have killed myself if I had not had a daughter. And, you know, my thoughts were, well, maybe this isn't his body. And as it turned out, that's what I did. My mind was so overwhelmed and I was so distraught that I hung onto this thread of maybe this wasn't him. And I see now in retrospect that that's what I had to do in order to survive. So I denied his death because I didn't see him dead. I denied it. And that denial, sadly to say, continued for 25 years until my daughter came to my door one day and said, I'm getting married. So we started planning her wedding, and I started having flashbacks to my own wedding and what happened after I got married. And I realized that I was letting go of the only piece of him that I had left, which was our daughter. And that's when I started writing and talking about being a Vietnam widow. And 7 years later, my book was finished, and I had cried all the tears that I couldn't cry back then. Because when his personal effects came back from Vietnam, I put it all in a box. I taped the box shut, and I stuck that box in the back of my closet. And every time I moved, I'd come across this box, Vietnam. And I'd get this foreboding feeling, and I'd say, you know, get this box in the back of the next closet quickly. Don't hang out with this box too long, because literally it feels like that grief is going to kill you. If you let yourself go into it, it feels like it could kill you. But the miraculous truth is that it will give you new life if you're willing to go to the grief. It will give you new life. I opened the box. I had given my daughter that box of things. I said, I need that box back. So she brought it back, and I opened the box, and I started going through the contents of it, and I had to do it very gradually because it was very scary for me. I could only do so much at a time, and then I would have to put it away. I was in Santa Rosa living in a small one-bedroom apartment, and the box was sitting in the middle of my living room, basically. My therapist was key because she's the first person in all these years that I found who would let me cry. I used to see her once a week for an hour, and basically I would just go sit in her office and cry, and she would allow me to cry. So I cried for 2 or 3 years, and then I started talking about why I was crying. Well, in the box were letters, personal effects, his wallet with pictures in his wallet, socks, underwear. There was a photo album that he had kept his photos in that I had sent him. And so there was a photo album of pictures of me pregnant at my mother's house. There was some pictures that he was going to send me that he had never sent me yet. So I was happy to see, you know, pictures of him in Vietnam. There were some audio tapes. At the time, we would send audio tapes back and forth. And his wedding ring was in there. And, you know, when I found his wedding ring, it was like the denial could not last any longer, because I knew that he must have been dead or his wedding ring wouldn't have come back. There was a couple, actually more than a couple letters that came back that they weren't in the box. They came back in the mail. They had been addressed to him, and there was a big red stamp on him that said, verified deceased, return to sender. Verified deceased. So in the box, it was all of his personal things in Vietnam, you know, the evidence that he was there. His wallet was wet. When he died, he was in water, and everything in his wallet was wet and moldy. So the whole box had that moldy smell to it, which I associate with Vietnam. You know, the combat vets, they associate gunpowder and blood the smell of gunpowder and blood together with Vietnam, but I associate this moldy box of letters that had been sealed up for 25 years. So the opening of that box was really the beginning of my healing. And so now all those things that were in the box are in a different box, and I've given them to my daughter and said, I've written my book, I've told my story, you want this stuff? So she has it now.
We thought we were invincible. You know, we were 18 years old, 19. We knew we weren't going to get it. The guys in the next plane might. But I can remember that feeling to this day, flying into battle with this mass of bombers with all these guns, and feeling the power of that situation, and feeling that no fighter was going to get to us. And somehow we felt invulnerable to, right up till the anti-aircraft shell hit a plane and it blew up, the guys in that plane thought they were invincible. I don't know why, but it's an attitude that we all carried, and I guess it was absolutely necessary in order to do the job we had. We had to be convinced of our indestructibility.
I think militaries in principle are a good thing. You need to have some people with guns to defend you, because there's a lot of people, bad people with guns in the world that will take over and rape people and everything, you know, just screw you up if you don't have some defense. But it appears to me that most of the time when militaries are used, it's not in defense of anything that should be defended. It's more like, I see countries as criminal gangs, basically.
Pacifists have said, you know, since then, yeah, but you killed people. And I said, yeah, yeah, that's what people do when they're attacked. They tend to kill the attackers. And I don't make any apologies for that. It's too bad the world has to be like that, but it is.
Yeah, there really has to be a better way of doing it. And I think there comes a time, well, I guess, when you have to use force. But it's only because we made too many mistakes, and I'm not sure we're not there right now.
I still feel killing is killing. And when you take somebody's life, I knew that Hitler was a terrible person. No question about that. But, you know, when I look at it, who made Hitler? Who made this person called Hitler? Where did he get all the money, that big war machine? Who gave him the money?
We, the soldiers who have returned from battles stained with blood, we who have seen our relatives and friends killed before our eyes, we who have come from a land where parents bury their children, we who have fought against you, we say to you today in a loud and clear voice, enough of blood and tears. Enough.
Yeah, I had an experience when they had the replica of the Vietnam Memorial at our junior college. And I went the day before because I wanted to check out the situation. And right as I pulled up my van, there was another van that pulled up. The other van was painted camouflage and had bumper stickers on it like, kill them all, let God sort out the rest. And there was this fella in there that was a double amputee with the army fatigues on, and he was there to check out the situation. And so was I. I was in my hippie van, and I had my headband on and my long braids. We both looked at each other when we got there, and we understood, you know, we understood each other why we were there.
You were listening to War Veterans. The voices you heard were Bill O'Hara, Clifton Amsbury, Dixon Ragg, James Spencer, Gene Watson, Judith Coates, Kevin Powers, Thomas, Lino Valentini, Lily Jean Adams, Tim Gregory, Sharon Kufelt, Tom Harriman, and Pauline Laurent. Literary quotes from Edmund Gossett, Joseph Demestre, Mussolini, William Burroughs, Thomas Hardy, von Clausewitz, Lloyd George, Mao Zedong, Machiavelli, Clemenceau, Ruth Benedict, and Yitzhak Rabin.
Several have written books or have websites. James Spencer's documentary novel, The Pilots, is published by Putnam and available everywhere. And Pauline Laurent has written of her experience as a war widow in Grief Denied, A Vietnam Widow's Story. Information on that is available at www.griefdenied.com.
Visit our website, www.hitching.org. You can listen to our past shows and the CD anthologies of the Hitchhiker's Audio Library, www.hitching.org.
You know, it's like when you're a veteran, there's a certain process that happens when you talk to people. Question comes up, and there's a certain line of questioning that happens, and it's like they'll ask you what branch of the service you're in. They'll ask you where you're stationed, and they'll ask you were you overseas, and then they'll ask you were you in the war, and then they'll ask you if you killed somebody. Then they'll ask you, did somebody try to kill you? And they'll want to know how that felt. And I think people ask this question of veterans, no matter which war they were in, because deep down inside, they really know that life is precious.